Welcome back to Human Emotion. So this is our final and third segment looking at the ways in which emotion can go awry and trying to understand how the basic processes and functions of emotion may sometimes literally unravel and fall apart. So today what we're going to be talking about is psychosis as well as personality disorders and the way in which they represent the ways emotion can go awry or unravel. So our roadmap today will go as follows. We'll start by looking at schizophrenia as a window into understanding psychosis and emotion. Next, we'll turn to borderline personality disorder as a key candidate personality disorder that really exemplifies difficulties in both emotion reactivity on the one hand and emotion regulation on the other. Then we'll conclude with our takeaway questions and expert interview. So let's begin first with schizophrenia, perhaps one of the most mysterious, the most elusive, and yet the most complex and difficult to treat, perhaps, of all emotional disorders. So when we think of schizophrenia and we turn to our three themes of emotion and psychopathology, the theme that's really gained prominence is not extremes or absences, but is this notion at the bottom, as you can see in yellow, of disjunctions. So this is this notion that we have this multi-componential emotion response system with subjective, behavioral, and physiological response components, and that in schizophrenia, what might be going on is that these channels are not aligning or they're not matching up correctly. So we're going to delve into precisely what way these emotion channels aren't mapping up and what this tells us about the emotional nature, inner life of individuals with this severe and costly psychiatric disorder. So schizophrenia. If we delve into the DSM and we look at the diagnostic criteria, what we see on the left is a broad category that really encapsulates wide sweeping disruptions in thought, in behavior, and in emotion. And in particular, when we look at these three categories, we see things that are really broken down into three symptom clusters. Positive symptoms, including delusions, hallucinations, and disorganized speech. Negative symptoms, including flat affect, a lack of pleasure, lack of motivation, and disorganized symptoms. So here we get into the sort of really kind of darker, mysterious realm of thought disorder and derailment. Importantly, schizophrenia is chronic or long-term, so it has to have a duration of at least 6 months minimum in order to warrant a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And like all emotional disorders we've talked about so far, it causes severe and chronic impairment. So I want to walk through some of these categories of symptoms that were just alluded to in the DSM to flesh them out a bit more. So first is the category of disorganized symptoms. So this is disorganization or incoherence of cognition and behavior. So this is thought of on the one hand in terms of disorganized speech or what's been called formal thought disorder. So this can be manifested in terms of incoherence. So an inability to try to organize ideas, loose associations. So kind of grabbing at ideas and bringing them together in a way that may not make logical sense to the rest of the world, as well as a very kind of fragmented or non-linear progression of thinking. Importantly, you also see disorganized behavior. So you see odd or unusual kinds of peculiar behaviors that don't necessarily map onto the kinds of behaviors you see amongst the rest of the general population. Second are what are called positive symptoms. So John Nash in A Beautiful Mind really exemplified some of these symptoms. So the positive, though importantly, is a misnomer. So by positive, what these mean are an excess or distortion of normal functioning. And there's different types of positive symptoms. There's three that you can see here. One are delusions. So these are erroneous beliefs. So you can have beliefs of persecutory, so believing that people are out to get you. These are very common in schizophrenia, referential thoughts, grandiosity, unusual religious thinking, as well as somatic things. So people may think for referentiality that things that are arranged in a room or coming from the TV or newspaper are especially targeted towards them personally. They may also have ideas of grandiosity, where they think they have special powers to do things that no one else can do, or have special religious insights or relationships with God that no one else has. Second positive symptom are hallucinations. So these are perceiving things visually, auditorily, olfactory, gustatory, any of your major senses. You're picking up on something that isn't necessarily there or that other people do not perceive to be there. So you're perceiving them in the absence of external sensory stimulation or input. And then finally is disorganized speech and behavior. So here we get into thought disorder. So not being able to coherently organize your thoughts or your behaviors. They're kind of in a very confusing, perhaps jumbled mishmash. And then the third category is negative symptoms. And again, negative is really a misnomer. So what we're talking about here is a deficit or lack of or diminution of normal functioning. So types of negative symptoms can include poverty of speech, a lack of motivation or goal-directed activity, a lack of pleasure or anhedonia, and importantly, and what I've starred at the bottom because it's most relevant to emotion research, is what's called flat affect or a sort of lack of outward expression. So you can see the picture of this young woman who's showing what we would think of as flat affect, so showing minimal emotion expressivity in her face. Now, what I want to do is just show you a very brief 3-minute video and think about which symptoms that you might see in this video. Are you seeing positive symptoms, negative symptoms, or disorganized symptoms? So take a look here, take some notes, and think about what you're seeing, and also think about the nature of emotional symptoms that might be emerging in this particular video.
I got TV tooth, they call it. TV tooth is when they surprise you and they put little needles into your scalp. And they listened to me for years, if you know it or not.
Really?
I didn't know it. They have this really fantastic, expensive equipment they touched me with. It's, they said to me, hey, we can check your head, you know, for if your bump shows up bruised and the electricity's a little different across the scalp of your scalp, we'll guarantee you Social Security from that injury or on its own. It's considered like cerebral palsy, but it would be muscular dystrophy kind of thing. And so I said, no, I'll think about it. And the next day he comes back and says, did you think about it? You know, give me a ride, you know, and all that. I said, well, okay, I'll look at it. Okay, let's go. And then they put the needle in. The last one they put in, they went like this. So when they did it, I had a thought that when they pulled them out, they pulled them out burned, but they left a little, teeny little barb in all, every one of the places they put me. And they recorded it. And one person who wanted it didn't. Someone else sold it to someone else, I don't know who, but they're able to give a response back because of the how thick the dental is in my teeth. I think the dental is, and with the needles, they're easy to focus a heavier field of pickup reception because of all the fillings I got. And so I...
Who's listening?
I think it's people like at Stanford, and... technicians, wealthy technicians and people that do stuff like NASA or any of that kind of stuff. Ames Institute. I came right up to them and tried to sell them that last little one. But for the amount of money they didn't have, I should have just gave it to them. I like watching Mr. Rogers, and I like my family, and I know it was a problem where my dad would just say, Peter, just go, leave him alone, because of the way the situation was. He never had too many arrests, so I'm the one that's got to go. A little ahead of rough-ups, you know. Hey, what'd you do that for? Why did you go like this first? I wanted to make it green. You know, you go up to your reference, right? And then they make it all green spot there, you know? Awful, you know, but... that's just how adorable we were.
So early observations of flat affect discussed in schizophrenia were really pioneered by Bleuler, who said that even in the less severe forms of the illness, There seemed to be an observable indifference that seemed to be the external sign of their state, an indifference to everything, to friends and relations, to vocation and enjoyment, to duties or rights, or to good fortune. So there was an early observation about the emotional life of individuals with schizophrenia that assumed that patients with schizophrenia must have diminished internal experience. Because they weren't showing anything on their face, it must mean that they had a really diminished internal emotional life as well. Now, this had been the assumption for most of the 1900s, until a pioneering researcher came in, Ann Kring from the University of California at Berkeley, who really thought of emotion and schizophrenia. She called it as an old mystery and pioneered a very new understanding of the emotional life of people with schizophrenia. So she talked about this notion of flat affect in schizophrenia. So in other words, in their emotional behavior, indeed, when she took the tools of emotion science, brought patients with schizophrenia into the lab, indeed, she saw that they show fewer facial expressions of emotions to films and pictures compared to controls, but, and this is the really critical part of her discoveries, they reported similar or even more intense internal emotion experience. So even though they weren't showing anything on their face, they actually were reporting a very vivid and rich internal emotional life. So this, what Ann Kring pioneered, is this really fascinating disjunction between emotion experience on the left-hand side, where individuals with schizophrenia do report comparable internal emotion to controls, from their outward emotional behavior, where they seem to be expressing very little or very subtle signs of emotionality. And she called this a disjunction, right, between these two response components. She really completely fired up the field to suggest that we've been making mistakes all along in assuming they don't experience emotion in the same way as the rest of us. She said, indeed they do, they're just not showing it in their face. Another important component of schizophrenia to know and think about is the home context that these individuals are often associated with. And this is this notion by Jill Hooley at Harvard University of expressed emotion, or EE. So she would ask the question of, why do patients with schizophrenia seem to be more likely to return to the hospital after discharge if they're living with their families than not? So why wouldn't they be more supported and comforted? And what she found is that, looking at expressed emotion in family discussions, what she found is that there's often hostility expressed in these family interactions towards the patient, criticism of the patient, and overprotective, over-involved attitudes. This is really the question of which comes first. Is it that these symptoms of schizophrenia create unusual thoughts in the patient that generate increased critical comments from the family? Or do increased critical comments from the family really trigger the onset of unusual patient thoughts? And this is a tricky bidirectional relationship, but it just suggests that part of the symptoms we see in schizophrenia, you know, may be emerging from the home life. And so is home really home sweet home in individuals with schizophrenia? And what this research has found is that individuals and families who are high in expressed emotion, as opposed to those who are low in expressed emotion, actually have and fare worse outcomes. So this is percent relapse here on the axis, for up to 60%. And you're seeing a higher rate of relapse in individuals who are in a high expressed emotion environment, who are in yellow, spending a high amount of time or high contact with their family. So if you're in that kind of environment, it's especially pernicious and predicts relapse much greater if you're spending more time with the partners. So in high EE families, contact may actually be bad for individuals, whereas in low EE families, contact can be a supportive buffer or good for patients. So now we're going to quickly turn to borderline personality disorder. So borderline personality disorder is part of a broader category of what we call axis to personality disorders. This includes also mental retardation. But when we zoom in on personality disorders, really what's important to know about them is they have a long-standing duration. These are things that emerge early in life. They're pervasive and thought of as being relatively inflexible patterns of behavior and inner experience. They deviate markedly from cultural expectations or norms. And this pattern leads to clinically significant distress or impairment across multiple domains of functioning. And this should be manifested in at least two of the following: cognitive, affective, interpersonal functioning or impulse control, and is not due to another mental disorder. So there are lots of overlap between different personality disorders, but I just want to show you the three broad clusters that have been discussed with respect to personality disorders. There's cluster A, odd or eccentric, cluster B, dramatic or erratic, and cluster C, anxious or fearful. And although this is not a class in abnormal psychology, what I'd like to do is just orient this to you to highlight in on what we're going to talk about today, which is borderline personality disorder here. So we're going to talk about borderline personality disorder because it's a really prominent and important personality disorder that really exemplifies core difficulties in emotion reactivity and regulation. So if we look at the DSM criteria for borderline personality disorder, what we see here is this idea of impulsive, unstable, stormy relationships, unstable sense of self, and as you can see here, emotion regulation problems. And a core part of what might be triggering this, people think, is a very difficult home environment. So having an early environment where behavioral patterns are fueled by parental punishing, ignoring a child's needs, but on the one hand, attending to behavioral outbursts. So when we think about these things of emotion regulation difficulties, how do they exactly look in borderline personality disorder when we apply the sort of lens of emotion science? So what research has shown is that in borderline personality disorder, what we're seeing is heightened emotion reactivity, particularly for negative emotions, as well as difficulty regulating emotions, having a really unstable positive and negative emotional repertoire. So I'll give you some key pieces of example before we wrap up today. So in one study that was recently published, they talked about borderline personality disorder as really thinking about it as a volatility from negative to positive and back again. So what they did is they followed individuals with bipolar disorder over the course of a 21-day experience sampling diary. And they had people self-report using something like a Palm Pilot, their daily experience of both positive and negative emotion. And using really sophisticated multi-level modeling techniques, what they found that was most diagnostic of borderline personality disorder was a rapid oscillation over the course of the week between positive and negative emotion. So they said what really seems to be a core feature of borderline personality disorder is the unstable, almost, vicissitudes of the emotions going up and down and back again. There's also been neuroimaging studies that look at amygdala activity in borderline personality disorder. Again, we talked about this as a brain region associated with both emotional salience and potentially as a fear center. And what we're seeing in borderline personality disorder is what seems to be amygdala hyperactivity. So we see increased activity, for example, in response to affective pictures and fearful faces, yet also having a reduced volume of the amygdala as well. Importantly, we also see reduced volume in prefrontal cognitive control regions like the medial and orbital prefrontal cortex, and we see failure of active engagement in response to negative or trauma-related scripts. We also see things like reduced functioning or adaptive functioning in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Again, another prefrontal cognitive control region. So we see increased activity in response to pain stimuli, but a failure of adaptive activation in response to trauma scripts. So what we're seeing is both at the self-reported, behavioral and neurological level, difficulties with reactivity and difficulty regulating emotions that seem to be unstable and wavering between positive and negative emotion extremes. Borderline personality disorder has been depicted widely in the media, but in one particular movie, with Angelina Jolie and Winona Ryder, Girl Interrupted, we see a lot of discussion and portrayals of what borderline personality disorder looks like. The treatment of borderline personality disorder really has been pioneered by Marsha Linehan at the University of Washington, who developed what's called dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT, where the goal here is to reach what she calls a state of wise mind, or a balance between both rational and emotional states. And she has four main modules of dialectical behavior therapy that include mindfulness, so observing emotions without judging them; second, interpersonal effectiveness, so being assertive, knowing how to say no, make a request, coping with life stressors effectively; third, distress tolerance; and fourth, and most importantly to what we've been talking about today, teaching individuals with borderline personality disorder how to effectively regulate emotions by both labeling them, managing them, and trying to increase experiences of healthy, positive emotions. So I want to just conclude, since this is our last lecture on emotional disorders, that by reminding ourselves that even though we've characterized many ways that emotions can be experienced to extreme or a relative deficit or even disjunction among emotion response components, that this is simply characterizing differences in the ways emotions are manifested and ways they cause difficulties for people, from anxiety disorders to mood disorders, schizophrenia to even personality disorders. But this doesn't imply that there's any judgment as to what is the best or most ideal emotion state. And as Hans Asperger said, not everything that steps out of line and thus abnormal must necessarily be inferior. So with that, I want to conclude with our takeaway questions. So the first question from today is as follows. How does schizophrenia represent an example of emotion disjunction? And what channels and specifically, or in particularly, is the emotion disjunction between? Second, in what way is emotion reactivity and regulation impaired in borderline personality disorder? And finally, what are the four core modules in DBT for treating borderline personality disorder, especially with respect to emotion-related difficulties? Finally, now we're going to conclude with our expert interview as part of the Experts in Emotion interview series. We'll be speaking with Dr. Anne Kring, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and a member of the Institute for Personality and Social Research on schizophrenia and emotion. Dr. Kring received a BS in psychology from Ball State University and her MA and PhD in clinical psychology from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Dr. Kring's research focuses on emotion and psychopathology with a specific interest in the emotional features of schizophrenia, assessing negative symptoms of schizophrenia and the linkage between cognition and emotion in schizophrenia. In addition, she also studies emotion in healthy individuals with a focus on individual differences in expressive behavior, gender differences in emotion, and linkages between cognition, personality, social context, and emotion. Dr. Kring has received numerous awards, including a Young Investigator Award from the National Alliance for Research on Schizophrenia and Depression, the Joseph Zubin Memorial Fund Award, and a Distinguished Teaching Award from UC Berkeley. She's currently president-elect for the Society for Research in Psychopathology and has served as an associate editor for the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, as well as Cognition and Emotion, and a member of the editorial boards for Schizophrenia Bulletin, Psychological Science in the Public Interest, and Applied and Preventative Psychology, Emotion, and Journal of Research in Personality. She's also the author or editor of three books and several scholarly papers in top journals in the field. So I now turn to our special Experts in Emotion interview with Dr. Anne Kring on schizophrenia and emotion. For our Experts in Emotion interview, we'll be speaking with Dr. David Watson on personality and emotion. Dr. Watson is the Andrew McKenna Family Professor of Psychology at the University of Notre Dame. Dr. Watson is a personality psychologist with particular expertise in personality assessment. His work investigates the structure and measurement of personality, mood, and psychopathology, as well as examining how personality traits relate to clinical disorders. He works in a variety of substantive areas within psychopathology, including depression and the anxiety disorders, personality disorders, schizotypy, and the sleep and dissociative disorders. The long-term goal of his work is to develop comprehensive taxonomic models that integrate normal range and pathological processes into a single overarching scheme. Dr. Watson has published more than 100 articles in the top journals in psychology, including the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, Psychological Bulletin, and Psychological Assessment, and he currently serves as editor-in-chief of the Journal of Abnormal Psychology. So I now turn to a very special Experts in Emotion interview with Dr. David Watson on personality and emotion.